Hey, Mike here. I just wanted to let you know that you can listen to Dark Poutine early and ad-free on Amazon Music, included with Prime. Welcome back to Dark Poutine. My name is Mike Brown, and I'm coming to you from the Dark Poutine studios in Langley, British Columbia, and my good friend Matthew Stockton is at his home, a little fancier, there in Vancouver. Hello, Matthew.
How was Los Angeles?
It was good. It was a busy time. I met with the guys from Gen Y, Justin and Aaron, and I met with Jamie from Murderish, and I met some other cool people, G.J. Echternkamp, who's a director, and he's directed a few movies, and one was Death Race 2050 for Roger Corman.
Ooh, sounds like a classic.
Well, it's funny. It's actually really well done, and GJ makes a couple of cameos in the movie in a really big way, so it's kind of funny.
You saw Banoffee as well.
Yes, I saw Cheryl Banoffee Pie.
Do you know what I watched last night?
No.
The first two episodes of Shogun.
I've seen it and I loved it. It's on Disney Plus.
Yeah, and Asuka, who is a listener and a member of the Umber Yard, worked on that show.
Mm-hmm. Yep. There's a few of my friends worked on that.
I scared the crap out of Justin when I'm like, screamed her name when I saw it in the credits. I texted her and let her know.
The views, information, and opinions expressed during the Dark Poutine podcast are solely those of the producer and do not necessarily represent those of Curious Cast, its affiliate, Global News, nor their parent company, Chorus Entertainment.
Dark Poutine is not for the faint of heart or squeamish. Listener discretion is strongly advised. We're not experts on the topics we present, nor are we journalists. We're two ordinary Canadians chatting about crime and the dark side of history. Let's get to it. Put on your toque, grab yourself a double-double and a Nanaimo bar. It's time to scarf down some Dark Poutine.
You are responsible for obtaining and maintaining at your own cost all equipment needed to listen to Dark Poutine. Dark Poutine can be addictive. Side effects may include, but not be limited to, pausing and questioning the system, elevated heart rate, pondering humanity, odd looks from colleagues as you laugh out loud at work, family members not into true crime worrying about you. Positive side effects may include some perspectives and opinions that you disagree with, as well as some wokeness and empathy. If you don't think Dark Poutine is for you, consult your doctor immediately.
Kimberly Lynn Hallgarth was a 33-year-old mother of one and one of former CFL football player Joshua Joseph Bowden's girlfriends. Kimberly was found brutally murdered at her residence in Burnaby, British Columbia on March 15, 2009. Her death was covered extensively in the media due to her connection with Bowden, who had a long history of legal entanglements and was the main suspect in her killing. After years of awaiting a resolution, Kimberly's murder finally got a whiff of justice when in 2018, Bowden was charged with the killing. There had been a witness to the crime, and she was willing to testify. This is Dark Poutine Episode 308, Apex Predator, The Murder of Kim Hallgarth. This story is personal and close to home. I became aware of this case in early January 2018 as it directly affected a former friend who knew the primary witness, Heidi Nissen, who had been present for the murder of Kimberly Hallgarth. Due to these interactions, I received screenshots of threatening messages alleged to have come from Joshua Bowden, which I will elaborate on later. For a few reasons, we had to wait until we covered this case. Chief among them was that we wanted to ensure it worked its way through the courts first. I have met Heidi Nissen, She was living at an undisclosed address by that time for her safety, as she had agreed to testify against Bowden and feared for her life and that of her children she shared with him. We did not directly discuss the case. At around 7 p.m. on Sunday, March 15, 2009, police were called to 6776 Colborne Avenue in Burnaby after friends and neighbors became concerned for the safety of the home's resident, Kimberly Hallgarth. When police entered the home, near the door at the bottom of the stairs leading up to her suite, they found Kimberly's battered body. One longtime resident of the neighborhood, 91-year-old George Thierman, told the Province newspaper's Frank Luba he hadn't heard anything at all before the police cruisers swarmed the usually quiet street on the evening of the discovery of Kim Hallgarth's body. Thierman said nothing unusual had happened at that address for as long as he could recall. However, two neighbors living in separate units of Kimberly Hallgarth's fourplex reported hearing disturbances in the wee hours of March 15, 2009. One resident was awakened around 3:30 a.m. by a loud noise resembling moving furniture, followed by a woman's sharp, brief scream. Sounds of a heated argument between a man and a woman soon followed this.
Do you remember your old flat where we used to record?
Yes.
And the neighbor upstairs that sounded like an elephant walking across the...
Yes. Yeah. Well, my current neighbors are elephantine as well, but not quite as bad.
I think the walls are a bit thicker in your new place, though.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Having thin walls is like living an audiobook subscription of your neighbor's lives, isn't it?
Yeah.
You can hear everything. I mean, my place, I think I could shoot a cannon in order to hear it because it's like concrete floors, ceilings, walls, you know? It's solid. You don't hear very much.
No. Shortly after hearing what appeared to be an argument, the witness described hearing noises suggesting someone hastily descending the stairs, possibly running or jumping down them, without any subsequent sounds. The same witness later heard the sounds of someone going down and then back up the stairs, but these noises were more typical of someone simply walking. A second resident on the ground floor reported being woken up at around 3 a.m. by the sound of a calm conversation between a man and a woman, which escalated into an argument, and then a shout of surprise from the woman. A loud noise like moving furniture soon followed this, then a heavy thud as if someone or something had fallen down the stairs. The witness also heard heavy breathing at the bottom of the stairs, suggesting someone had exerted themselves physically. A female voice was heard reassuring a male that everything would be okay, with the female's voice coming from somewhere on the stairs but not at the bottom. After returning to bed, the witness noted a quiet period before hearing the sound of a woman's heels as if someone briefly returned to the scene before leaving. No further sounds were heard after this. According to CBC News, Integrated Homicide Investigation Team Detective Corporal Dale Carr of the Burnaby RCMP said to reporters, quote, "At this point of the investigation, there is nothing to suggest that this is linked to gangs, drugs, or organized crime. However, as the investigation progresses, that will become clearer." Carr continued, "Investigators are not able to clearly offer an opinion on the manner of death. An autopsy is expected in the coming days." End quote. At the scene, the police noted a broken handrail about halfway down the stairwell. There were blood stains at the top of the stairwell, as well as a piece of a fingernail. DNA extracted from carpet fibers at the top of the stairwell and from the fingernail later matched Kimberly Hallgarth. Due to inconsistencies in the evidence, it appeared to the seasoned investigative team that the scene might have been staged to look as though Kimberly had fallen down the stairs accidentally killing herself.
That's so sloppy. Forensics are so good now that I would imagine it's extraordinarily difficult to stage a murder to look like an accident.
Toxicology tests showed that Kimberly had been intoxicated at the time of her death. However, if she had fallen down the stairs, the injuries sustained would not have led to her demise. Court documents indicate that the pathologist who performed the autopsy determined that Kimberly Hallgarth died from asphyxiation by prolonged manual strangulation. Blunt force injuries to her face and chest were consistent with someone having stomped on her. These injuries required a significant amount of force. Paraphrasing her obituary, Kimberly Lynn Hallgarth Aaron McDaniel, was born on July 8, 1975. Known affectionately as Kimmy, she left behind a legacy of love and joy, including her beloved daughter Haley, whom she cherished deeply. As well as her daughter Haley, Kimberly was survived by four brothers, Jamie, Chris, Rob, and Ken, two sisters, Vicky and Tammy, her father Bill, her husband Harry, her nieces Heaven and Larissa, and numerous aunts, uncles, and friends. Her family and friends vowed to keep her spirit alive in their hearts forever, promising to always look after her Haley bear. Kim's life journey saw her being born a Hallgarth, embracing life as an Aaron, and eventually becoming a McDaniel through marriage. Those who knew her would attest to her ever-present happiness and pride as a mother above all else. Her smile was constant, a testament to her strength, rarely revealing moments of sadness and always delighting those around her. In a later statement, Kimberly's family wrote in part, quote, "Kim was a bubbly and caring person who deeply loved being the mother to Haley, and the void that her murder left in our hearts can never be filled. She loved life and was able to make everyone around her laugh. For those of you who knew Kim, you know that she had a heart of gold and genuinely cared about everybody she was close to. We will always remember her infectious laugh." Her obituary contains stern words for the individual accountable for her death, stating, quote, "You deserve to be punished. While you run free, I hope you think about the little girl whose mother you took," end quote. According to CTV News, Kimberly Hallgarth's mother, Wendy, says she was a sweetheart. She went to Vegas when she was 18, worked in the clubs down there as a hostess, Hallgarth said. "She came here when she was expecting because she didn't want her daughter to be born down there. It's just so hard to fathom that it could happen to her, you know, that she's gone," her mother said. "Your kids aren't supposed to go before you."
All the family's pain is hard to take, but whenever I read about a mother's pain, it always... Yeah. You always picture your own mom, right? And it's so hard to hear from mothers and whenever we do these shows.
Thankfully, little Haley had not been at home at the time of Kimberly's murder, but had been with a babysitter, and after that was cared for by her family. According to The Province, while Kim was the proprietor of a tanning salon, there were reports from various media organizations that she also worked periodically as an escort. Police looked into this revelation as a possible motive for the crime, but there was only one suspect from Kim Hallgarth's past who quickly bubbled to the top, Joshua Joseph Bowden. Only months before her death, Kimberly Hallgarth had testified at trial for charges brought against Bowden for, among other things, an assault on her. Bowden had told more than one person that he believed Kim Hallgarth to be responsible for the death of his professional football career. And he wanted her to pay, one way or another. Joshua, Josh, Joseph Bowden, was born in Vancouver on December 12, 1986. Josh Bowden's life before his football career is not widely documented in public sources. The available information primarily focuses on his time as a football player, both amateur and professional, and his subsequent legal troubles. Specific details about his early life, including his upbringing, family background, and how he got into football, are not readily available in the public domain. Bowden was competitive and loved to win, which are the traits of most professional athletes. He had darker features, though. He was aggressive and felt the world owed him whatever he wanted, and he would take it however he could. Later testimony reveals that Bowden's troubles started before and ran congruent with his football career. During his tenure in the Canadian Junior Football League, CJFL, Josh Bowden showcased his talent with the South Surrey Rams, now known as the Langley Rams, within the British Columbia Football Conference, BCFC. In his singular season with the team, Bowden distinguished himself by receiving several prestigious accolades. He was named BCFC's Most Outstanding Receiver, Special Teams Player, Offensive Player, and Rookie of the Year. His exceptional performance also earned him the CJFL Rookie of the Year Award, highlighting his significant impact on the field in his first year of play. Bowden had grown into an intimidating figure, weighing 205 pounds, 93 kilograms, and he stands 6 feet 1 inch tall. That's 1.85 meters. In 2005, Joshua Bowden participated in the BC Lions training camp and impressed coaches during a preseason match against the Calgary Stampeders by scoring a 14-yard touchdown. Following this performance, the BC Lions signed him as a free agent in May 2006, placing him on the territorial protected list. Bowden returned to the training camp in 2006, where he secured a spot on the developmental roster. By 2007, he had progressed to the main team's roster, serving as a backup wide receiver. A notable moment in his career came on September 29, 2007, when he caught his first pass in the Canadian Football League, CFL, ending the game with three catches for a total of 83 yards. Throughout the 2007-2008 CFL season, Bowden caught 14 passes for 237 yards and zero received touchdowns in his career. In April 2008, BC Lions coach Wally Buono received a call from Kimberly Hallgarth. She reported that Joshua Bowden had assaulted her and caused damage to her car. Bowden admitted to arguing with Kim when questioned about the incident, but claimed her account was exaggerated. Kimberly also sent photos of her injuries to coach Buono, who did not like what he saw. In mid-May 2008, the BC Lions moved on from Josh Bowden. This decision came in the wake of Bowden facing domestic assault and theft charges related to the incident with Kim Hallgarth on April 12, 2008 in Burnaby.
Well, that's really good. There used to be a time when sports organizations would not sort of kick somebody out, if you will.
For domestic stuff.
Domestic stuff, other stuff, just sort of blindly kind of go, well, he plays well on the field, right?
Yeah. Well, I think there was that old, way of thinking, well, he's an asset, right?
Yeah.
Which is,
he's just an ass, not an asset.
Maybe, yeah.
And it just goes to show the damage that it can do to a brand, right?
Mm-hmm. I'm glad that organizations are more willing to be accountable for the people who represent them now.
I think ice hockey has been having a challenge in being managing that accountability lately, haven't they?
There have been a few instances with our home team, actually, the Canucks, where they reacted, I think, very appropriately in dealing with a player's off-ice behavior.
Yeah.
But Hockey Canada, this is probably something we'll deal with in an episode, but Hockey Canada right now is really
under fire. Yeah.
Yeah. On August 15th, 2008, Kent Spencer from the Province newspaper reported the collapse of the assault case against Bowden filed by the Crown after the alleged assault on Kim Hallgarth. She was the prosecution's only witness. Despite a dramatic courtroom encounter where Kim glared at Josh Bowden, her recollection of the events on the night of the alleged assault was unclear. She admitted being under the influence of alcohol and said she could not recall who smashed her car window during the incident. The Crown Counsel, Adam Dalrymple, decided to stay the proceedings after consulting with Hallgarth outside the court, citing her lack of cooperation and diminished likelihood of securing a conviction. Defense lawyer Herbert Meyer suggested that Hallgarth's conscience prevented her from accusing Bowden under oath, interpreting this as a moment of justice being served.
Mm.
Yeah, that's definitely something a defense lawyer would say.
Yeah, I think it sounds like he said this after the fact, which he probably didn't have to do. And, for me, if I have a defense lawyer, you want him, fully defending. I wonder if he's eating his words now.
Especially after what happened.
Mm.
The above-mentioned news report goes on to highlight the tumultuous nature of Bowden and Hallgarth's relationship and the impact of the legal proceedings on Bowden's football career. With the charges dismissed, Bowden looked forward to resuming his professional life in sports. However, BC Lions general manager Wally Buono later stated he did not intend to re-sign Bowden due to his legal troubles. 3 months following his release from the BC Lions, Josh Bowden was officially signed by the Hamilton Tiger Cats on September 24, 2008, just before a game scheduled on September 27th against the BC Lions at BC Place. However, Bowden never participated in a regular season game for the Tiger Cats. His release from the team was attributed to Chris Bauman's recovery from post-concussion issues, as general manager Bob Obilovich explained. Bowden's legal troubles continued, When on October 12, 2008 in Vancouver, Josh Bowden faced legal charges related to firearms, including the possession of a loaded handgun and the possession of an unloaded handgun with ammunition easily accessible. He was released on bail pending trial on those charges. Bowden was livid. He was only 21 years old and his professional football career was finished. His ego wouldn't allow him to take responsibility for what occurred. He seethed with resentment toward Kimberly Hallgarth, and those around him knew it. More after a quick break. And we are back. Matthew, thoughts so far?
It's just so often we see these perpetrators with the same mentality. This sort of like total lack of accountability combined with an ego that really needs to be right-sized.
Yeah.
And I don't know, is there more, do we just hear more about it? Sort of this total inability for any genuine introspection or growth or accountability in people?
Well, the word narcissist gets tossed around a lot.
Yeah.
But if someone does have narcissistic features to their personality, improvement is not something they think they need to do. So, you know, it's that old adage, how many psychiatrists does it take to change a light bulb?
How many?
One, but the light bulb really has to want to change. After Kim Hallgarth's body was found and it was determined she'd been murdered, as we mentioned, Josh Bowden quickly rose to the top of IHIT's suspect list. His past violent interactions with her, coupled with the blame he laid at her feet for the brevity of his time in the CFL, gave investigators great reasons to look long and hard at Josh Bowden's possible involvement in that crime. Even though Josh was in a common-law relationship with 19-year-old Heidi Nissen, he continued to see Kim Hallgarth, whom he'd known for years. Heidi was aware of Josh's relationship with Kim, but was terrified of Bowden, who had a strong hold over her, intimidating her mentally, emotionally, and physically. Heidi was a troubled teen when she met Josh Bowden at Kitsilano Beach. She was 14 years old and he was 17 or 18. She later said that she'd made the first when she approached him and asked for his phone number. After that, they hooked up in Stanley Park for sex. After much initial love bombing and coercion, Josh Bowden convinced Heidi to go to work for him in the sex trade. He sent her to Seymour Street, a well-known prostitution stroll, taking all of the money from her sexual encounters. Josh had Heidi well under his thumb. A friend of Kim Hallgarth's, Anastasia Fetisova, had seen Josh Bowden several times at Kim's place, including a week before Hallgarth's death. According to court documents, Anastasia mentioned that she'd witnessed Josh and Kim often arguing and raising their voices at one another. While she didn't see any physical violence, she characterized their relationship as unhealthy and detrimental to both parties. Kim had a strong bond with her mother-in-law, who observed Bowden subjecting Kim to verbal abuse. Before her murder, Kim had shared her feelings of fear toward Bowden. In interviews with police, Josh Bowden readily admitted to an ongoing sexual relationship with Kim Hallgarth, who was also apparently working for Josh in the sex trade. Bowden said that in the days leading up to her death, he had been seeing Kim almost daily, and their interactions often included sexual intercourse. This could explain why police had discovered Josh Bowden's DNA at the scene, on the waistband and exterior ankle of Kim's pants. There were other connections too. The evening before Kim Hallgarth's murder, March 14, 2009, things had come to a head in the apartment that Bowden and Heidi Nissen shared. Bowden had accused Heidi of performing sex work for another pimp, which she denied. Having had enough, Heidi left their apartment screaming at Josh as she went. Seeing he was losing control, Josh became angry and chased Heidi down. He grabbed her, threw her back onto their patio, where he proceeded to kick her in the ribs, berating her.
That's just such a fragile man, isn't it? He feels like he needs to do that to a woman when she's showing her own... what word am I looking for?
Agency.
Her own agency. you know, and it's, you know, this always gets me upset. I just wish as a society we'd be more open and honest about sex work. Mm-hmm. So we could protect women so they don't have right. to be under the thumb of men like this guy.
Yeah.
Right. Like brothels, for example, right? Pay up front, security, keep people safe. Hell, you know, as much as I hate paying taxes, I do anyway. And, you know, like have people pay taxes.
Exactly. Right?
Just have yeah. it, have it regulated. So they're safe instead of like having to deal with people like this.
Even the way we do it now, even the way Canada does it right now, still leaves sex workers behind the eight ball and a lesser person in society.
Well, that's the system, but it's also the sort of moral panic of people, right? It's like,
mm-hmm. Heidi managed to escape from Bowdoin that evening and went to a safe house for abused women. A staff member at the shelter characterized her as being, quote, absolutely terrified, withdrawn, and shaking, end quote. Heidi left the shelter just before 3 a.m. on March 15th, hopping into a taxi and driving to Kim Hallgarth's place. Heidi and Kim did not have the best relationship with one another. It was sometimes adversarial. Heidi later said that Kim had been jealous of Heidi's closeness to Josh Bowdoin. On two separate instances, Kim Hallgarth had driven by Heidi on Seymour Street, shouting at her and throwing pennies at her the first time, and cigarettes during another encounter. Josh had isolated Heidi so well that she felt she had nowhere else to turn other than to Kim Hallgarth. Bowdoin had told Heidi that Kim worked for him too, so she felt she had some common ground to work from and perhaps would find an ally there. She called Kim three times that morning, at 2:09, 2:29, and at 2:48 a.m. When the taxi arrived, Kim came out and paid the taxi driver, and she and Heidi went inside. When questioned by police several times in the days after Kim's murder, Heidi lied and told police what Josh Bowdoin wanted them to hear. Bowdoin's hold over Heidi was strong. She was terrified of him, so she soon moved in with her uncle. In April 2009, after Josh threatened Heidi, revealing a gun, she called the police and told them she was ready to tell them what had happened at Kim Hallgarth's and that Josh Bowdoin had killed Kim and she had witnessed the crime. When questioned about her initial lies, Heidi admitted her fear of Josh was a driving factor. Nonetheless, she described her connection with him as, quote, very strong and considered him, quote, the only person she truly had in the, quote, whole entire world. Despite being scared of him, she also believed she was in love with Josh Bowdoin. The police tried to convince Heidi to testify against him, but she was in fear for her life and unsure if she could do it. In the meantime, Josh Bowdoin was in trouble again, this time for something else, sexual assault. He was already out on bail for the gun charges, and the Crown prosecutor tried to have Bowdoin's bail revoked pending these new charges, however, was unsuccessful. According to Kim Boland's article in the Vancouver Sun on September 25, 2009, quote, Bowdoin was alleged to have attacked two women, one at Commercial Drive and Broadway Avenue on September 7th, and another in 1700 block of Alberni August 29th. Both attacks occurred near SkyTrain stations. Bowdoin faced one charge of sexual assault after a number of women reported being groped by a man on the streets of Vancouver, end quote. Bowdoin was bailed for $5,000 on these charges, which led police to warning the public that he was a danger to them, especially considering he was the main suspect in Kim Hallgarth's murder. Bowdoin's gun charges had been dismissed due to a lack of evidence that the firearm worked. A technicality got him off. There were other charges as well, resisting arrest and assaulting a police officer, and he would go to trial for those later. Despite talking to police about Kim Hallgarth's murder, Heidi Nissen's relationship with Josh Bowdoin continued. After discovering she'd become pregnant with his child, she moved in with Josh and recanted her witness testimony to police in May 2010. Although everything Heidi told police lined up with the evidence at the scene, Heidi now claimed she lied and heard everything secondhand.
It's such a shame that she couldn't feel like she had the safety she needed to be able to tell the truth at this point. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's hard for me to
understand because nobody would ever have a hold on me like that.
Right.
But intellectually, I get it. I can't feel it, but intellectually, I get it. That, you know, I kind of see her as sort of this slow motion, long term victim. You know what I mean? For her to have to live the life she was living, imagine being torn between that guilt of you knowing what happened on one side, but fear for yourself on the other.
So this is where trauma bonding actually comes into things. So for those who aren't aware, trauma bonds refer to the strong emotional connections formed between a person and an abuser, and they're developed through a cycle of abuse, devaluation, and then positive reinforcement again. So it's this crazy, vicious circle. This complex dynamic often arises in abusive relationships where periods of love and affection are interspersed with episodes of harm, creating a powerful psychological attachment. Victims may find it difficult to leave the abusive situation due to these bonds, as their intermittent positive reinforcement can lead to a sense of loyalty or attachment to the abuser, despite the harm being done. So understanding and addressing trauma bonds is crucial in the process of healing and moving toward healthier relationships. But it was clear that that's what was going on with Heidi at the time, I think.
Yeah, and like I said, like intellectually I get it because I've read up on the stuff you just said. But I feel for her. I wish she felt a sense of self-worth she wouldn't have had at this point in time. You know?
Yeah. In December 2010, Josh Bowden went on trial for the sexual assault charges. According to an article by Susan Lazaruk, Josh Bowden appeared uncomfortable in court as a victim recounted her experience. The victim, a legal assistant, described how on August 13, 2009, Bowden followed her into an elevator in Vancouver, eventually assaulting her as she exited. Despite her anger and feeling violated, she confronted him only verbally due to her fear of further aggression. Bowden, dressed in a business suit, attempted to avoid being seen by the victim in court. The woman testified that she did not immediately report the incident to police, but did so after her boss informed her of Bowden's arrest for similar offenses. She recognized Bowden from social media and news reports, prompting her to report the assault. The trial also included testimony from another victim and a police officer who chased Bowden during his arrest. After a year's worth of delays, in December 2011, despite pleading not guilty, Josh Bowden was found guilty of two counts of sexual assault, with a third count resulting in acquittal, and one count each of assaulting and obstructing a police officer. His sentencing hearing was anticipated in 2012, but his troubles continued. Josh's troubles started again with charges for uttering threats on January 14, 2012, though these charges were eventually dismissed. While on bail for previous charges on April 13, 2012, he was charged with four counts of assault at Tinseltown Cinema in Vancouver. On July 26, 2012, Crown lawyer Michaela Donnelly recommended a one-year jail sentence for Bowden due to his conviction of the sexual assaults at Vancouver SkyTrain stations earlier. Ultimately, on August 31, 2012, Bowden was sentenced to a year in prison for the 2009 sex crimes, along with charges of obstruction and assaulting a police officer. He served 6 months with credit for time already spent in custody and was placed on probation for 3 years following his release.
He just constantly gets into trouble. Tinseltown, that's one of my cinemas.
Yeah, I've been there a bunch of times.
Not far from me.
Unfortunately, the
neighborhood around Chinatown sort of going downhill fast right now. Mm-hmm. Hoping that it can be cleaned up. But yeah, that's scary to think that's like a few blocks from my place.
Yeah. In 2014... Josh Bowden was charged with four counts of assault causing bodily harm stemming from the Tinseltown incident and breaching probation conditions stemming from allegations by a woman who claimed Bowden had assaulted her several times since 2013. However, these charges were dismissed in court. Additionally, on July 15, 2014, Josh Bowden was charged with several offenses related to sex work, including procuring someone to be a sex worker, living on the avails of sex work, aiding a person to engage in sex work, and criminal harassment linked to incidents in Vancouver and Port Moody in February of 2014. These charges were also thrown out of court. Victims of Bowden were initially willing to talk to police about his antics, but when it came time to testify, as Kim Hallgarth did, they would balk out of fear of Josh Bowden. Every article about Bowden's legal troubles ended with a paragraph about Kim Hallgarth's unsolved murder, pointing to Josh Bowden's connections with her. It was not publicly known whether police had even questioned Josh then, but it was a safe assumption that later proved accurate. Heidi Nissen and Josh Bowden were in an on-again, off-again relationship for nearly 10 years after Kim Hallgarth's murder. By 2017, the couple had become parents of two children. The relationship was marked by significant strife, with numerous instances requiring police intervention and the engagement of the Ministry of Children and Family Development. Despite the imposition of no-contact orders designed to separate them, both parties violated these restrictions. And again, it goes to these trauma bonds.
What strikes me here, you mentioned on again, off again for 10 years since Kim's murder.
Yeah.
It's been so long. Like, let's not lose Kim in this, right? It's been so long since she's been murdered at this point. And I'm just imagining her family, right? This is 10 years so far after their daughter, their sister, their cousin, niece, whatever, was murdered, right?
Yeah. Investigators still believed Heidi had been at the scene of the murder and wanted to talk to her further, hoping she would testify against Bowden and finally give Kim Hallgarth's family some closure. Feeling the heat, Josh fled Canada to St. Vincent and the Grenadines. St. Vincent and the Grenadines is a multi-island country in the Lesser Antilles chain in the southeastern Caribbean. Known for its vibrant culture, lush tropical landscapes, and stunning volcanic beaches, it comprises the main island of St. Vincent and a chain of smaller islands known as the Grenadines. Its capital, Kingstown, is situated on St. Vincent and is known for its botanical gardens, among the oldest in the Western Hemisphere. The nation's economy primarily relies on agriculture, tourism, and the service sector. St. Vincent and the Grenadines is celebrated for its breathtaking natural beauty, including the La Soufriere volcano, the Tobago Keys Marine Park, and its rich biodiversity, making it a popular destination for ecotourists and sailing enthusiasts. It was in early 2018 that I became aware of Joshua Bowden in a personal way. A former friend in Surrey met Heidi at his daughter's school and they began talking. My friend offered to take photos of Heidi and her son on the school playground, and Heidi later posted the innocent photos on her Facebook page, as did my friend on his. Soon after, the photographer received threatening Facebook messages from alias accounts we learned allegedly belonged to Joshua Bowden. He was sending the messages from St. Vincent and the Grenadines. These texts were shared with me. They're rambling and unhinged, to say the least, but the threats are clear. One set of messages came with a friend request from a person calling himself Jason McKay. The first message read, "Look, I will not say this again. You go by my kids again, you will see what happens to your little girl before someone else does the same to you." The second message reads, "Take down every picture of the kid that you had such a good day in the snow with. That will never be your family as long as I'm living," end quote. The next rambling message from someone calling himself Lou Who, with a pink butterfly as a profile picture, sent direct threats. The communication came without punctuation and grammatical errors, so I have deciphered and added my own punctuation to help with the flow and clarity. It doesn't help much. In addition to threats, some of the language is definitely not safe for work, so word of warning there. Quote, "You're going to get some one day. Not tomorrow, but down the road. Ask Heidi how she was a streetwalker from 14, working the corner streets downtown for years, sucking and fucking for money for me. Ask the cops if you're safe or if you should start to hide with your two girls. I'll take and sell them till no one wants them. And listen, you fuck. Take my fucking kid down. Every pic on your ugly Facebook page. Ask Heidi. She will tell you whatever. Ask the cops. They will tell you. I will or have someone come for you and bring your two girls and my boys and leave you and Heidi not breathing. If I see the pics up again, you will just see the ghost come when he comes. I can wait for just the right time. Don't play with your life. And the message ends with a ghost emoji, a gun emoji, and a knife emoji.
So reading the actual text he sent, yeah. I literally would have no idea what this guy was trying to say to me. It's barely in English. And it just, it strikes me that, okay, first of all, as you said, this guy's totally unhinged and strikes me as not very bright. And I'm thinking, why the heck isn't he in jail? Like, it's not like this guy's some Mensa criminal mastermind. He's a low-level thug with a not a very high IQ.
Well, here's the thing about this guy is he is menacing and very threatening. And
well, then arrest him, right?
But this is the thing. You arrest him, and then the people who you need to testify are terrified to testify. And this happened over and over and over again with this guy.
Horrible human.
The only jail time he did was that for the sexual assaults for the people who actually came forward and said that they were willing to testify. But yeah. In other cases, people close to him, especially, they knew he was dangerous and they were terrified of him. Mm. Heidi Nissen was made aware of the text messages, as were the Surrey RCMP, who interviewed both my friend and Heidi. Police told my friend that Josh Bowden was known for making online threats in the way he had in this case. My friend and Heidi stayed in touch, and she let him know that she was talking to IHIT again. In messages to my friend, Heidi admitted that she had been there on the night of Kim Hallgarth's murder, was in witness protection, but had left to go back to Josh, and the case against him fell apart. After Bowden's recent threats to my friend, Heidi admitted she was in contact with IHIT again. She said she couldn't live with the guilt of her knowledge anymore, and that Josh was out of the country, so she decided to tell the truth. She had also contacted Kim Hallgarth's brother. In the text to my friend, Heidi reiterated her shock at seeing the content of the threatening texts sent by Bowden. She wrote that he'd not said anything like that to her or about her that she was aware of, and that this was a wake-up call. She was the only witness to Kim's murder, and she wanted to do the right thing despite personal danger to her. Police told Heidi she needed to make a clean break from Bowden, and she and her children went to live in an undisclosed location with the financial support and assistance of the police, and it was during this time that I met her. She's a very kind person, albeit, for obvious reasons, seemed quite guarded. It isn't clear why, but one can assume that it had to do with Heidi Nissen going underground. Josh Bowden was arrested, and in November of 2018, he was finally charged with Kim Hallgarth's murder. At a Surrey news conference, Kim's brother, Jamie Aaron, said, quote, "We recognize that nothing can bring Kim back. However, we need and deserve closure and are glad to see this next step today." Aaron thanked police for their hard work and continued, quote, "We have waited nearly 10 long years for this moment and are relieved that closure is in sight. Only we know the unimaginable grief that our family has been going through and the toll it has taken on every family member," he said. "What we have been going through is something that no family should ever have to experience," end quote. Ultimately, Heidi Nissen testified at Joshua Bowden's trial by judge alone. She described in horrific detail his involvement in the murder. According to court documents, when Heidi arrived at Kim Hallgarth's house, she saw Kim was upset and crying. When she reached the top of the stairwell at the entrance to Kim's home, she saw why. Josh Bowden was already there. He came, quote, "barreling out from the living room area and was livid. He began yelling and screaming at her. Heidi started to cry. Bowden accused her of wanting to work in the sex trade for someone else. She threw herself on her knees and apologized. Kim Hallgarth did the same, reminding Bowden that he said that he would not hurt Heidi. After that, Kim went in the direction of the bedroom and the bathroom. Bowden proceeded to hit Heidi in the head with a closed fist. He then followed Kim Hallgarth. Heidi heard the two of them struggle, and Kim said she was going to call the police. Bowden returned to Heidi at this point and placed one of his hands around her windpipe and the other at the back of her neck. He choked her, and she lost consciousness. Heidi testified that when she awoke, the home was silent. She knew something was wrong. She walked to the top of the stairwell and looked down. Kim was lying at the bottom of the stairwell by the front door. She was on her back. There were, quote, dark, dark marks all over her neck. The former wide receiver stood over Kim Hallgarth with one foot on her neck. He had socks on his hands. He lifted his foot and placed it back down and then, quote, pushed all of his weight onto her neck, end quote. Bowden asked Heidi to get a pair of socks. She did. She walked down a couple of stairs and handed the socks to him. Kim was gasping for air. Josh Bowden shoved the socks down her throat. He walked up the stairs and went in the direction of the kitchen. He returned with two bottles of prescription pills. He took the socks out of Kim's mouth and dumped the pills all over her mouth. Some went into her mouth. Others fell around her. Bowden again put rolled up socks into Kim's mouth, pushing them down her throat. He also choked Kim with his hands. Heidi testified that Bowden moved Kim's body so that her head was facing a door and her legs, feet, or ankles were at the bottom of the stairs. He told Heidi to get a blanket. He got two garbage bags. He used a towel to, quote, wipe down Kim. He put the towel into one of the garbage bags and put some other things in it. He proceeded to snap off Kim Hallgarth's fingernails. Josh and Heidi left the residence together. Josh had the two garbage bags with him. Josh called for a taxi cab once they were a couple of blocks away from the residence, and this fact was confirmed through phone records. The next day, he told Heidi he had to dispose of the bags and then left their apartment for 15 minutes to a half an hour.
So did the police not have these phone records before?
They did. And so here's the thing. Like, he admitted to having been in that apartment, having sexual relations with Kim Hallgarth a number of times in the days leading up to her death. And this all explained away his being there. You know, all he and Heidi would have had to say at this point, I'm speculating what the lie was, yeah, we were there. We had an argument. We left. And Kim was fine when we walked out the door. And if both of them say that,
yeah.
Josh's defense attorney vigorously challenged Heidi's testimony, even suggesting she might be the murderer. During a cross-examination, Kevin Westell, the lawyer representing Josh Bowden, grilled Heidi about her feelings toward Bowden, suggesting she was obsessed with him. Heidi countered, expressing that her feelings were more about confusion and fear with the relationship rather than obsession. This was highlighted by a 2009 police statement where Heidi Nissen admitted to being obsessed with Bowden. However, she clarified to Justice Barry Davies that her predominant feelings were that of being trapped, isolated from family and friends, with only Bowden in her life. Heidi shared that therapy had helped her understand the nature of her relationship with Bowden, identifying it as a cycle of abuse rather than love. Despite Westell questioning the influence of therapy on her perspective, Heidi became overwhelmed by emotion, leading to a pause in the proceedings, and the testimony was conducted via video link to the courtroom, underscoring the sensitive nature of the case and the emotional toll on Heidi Nissen. Again, she was terrified of Josh Bowden, and so they had her via closed-circuit TV in another room in the court, so she wouldn't have to be in the same room with him.
Yeah, and some people might see the Kevin Westell, the defense lawyer, being hard. But quite frankly, if I needed a defense lawyer, I would have expected him to do exactly the same thing.
Sure.
Right? Their job is to defend. And, you know, Heidi, you know, it's one of those things where I think, you know, you have to prove mental incapacity, you know, in terms of saying that you're crazy when you did something. And I think sort of the idea of trauma bonding, it's something that, you know, they also have to make sure that that's actually the case. And if I was a defense lawyer, I'd be right on it, right? Mm-hmm. Because you have a job to do for your client.
Yeah. Yeah. I see some defense attorneys are a strange breed. and some of them, I think, perhaps they do their job maybe a little too vigorously and don't care in a way.
You say that until you need a good defense lawyer.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. Ultimately, Heidi's testimony was the key to the judges finding Joshua Bowden guilty of second-degree murder. In 2021, Bowden was convicted of Kim Hallgarth's murder. British Columbia Supreme Court Justice Barry Davies subsequently sentenced Josh Bowden to life in prison with no chance of parole for 14 years. As he was let out of court, presumably to Kim Hallgarth's family, Joshua Bowden called out, "Have a good day."
No.
What a class act.
Well, we will. And you have a good 14 years minimum.
Yeah, it's a life sentence with 14 years minimum. Yeah. And I'm sure that Kim's family is going to still be around in 14 years and are going to be more than willing to have conversations with the parole board about why they think he shouldn't be set free. But we'll see.
And I think, you know, yelling "have a good day" after you've been sentenced probably won't bode well for a parole board or any mm-hmm. other threats he feels like he would need to make, you know, from jail. You know,
I wouldn't be surprised if there was attempts to determine whether or not he's a dangerous offender because of his history and those kind of things. Other than murder, there were a lot of things going on with this guy.
A lot. And he, so far, there's absolutely no remorse being shown whatsoever or penance, right?
Yeah, we don't know what's happened in the 2 months since, you know, his appeal. Maybe he's turned around. Maybe he's turned over a new leaf.
Maybe he found Jesus.
Well, was he missing? I don't know if that guy was ever missing. But anyway, Joshua Bowden and his attorneys appealed his case on alleged issues with Heidi Nissen's testimony. In January of 2024, three justices of BC's appeals court dismissed the appeal and Josh Bowden remains in prison. This is by far my closest brush with a murder, and frankly, that's close enough. And that's it for Dark Poutine episode 308, Apex Predator, The Murder of Kim Hallgarth.
That's right. It's time for voicemails. You can leave us a message at 1-877-327-5786 or 1-877-DARK-PTN. We'd love to hear from you. Let's see who called us this week.
So we don't have any voicemails this week, but, you know, I know someone's going to call us at some point.
I think Banoffee should call us and tell us, like, the most fun bit of your trip.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, Cheryl, give us a call. Please, somebody call us. Yeah, but yeah, it's fine. People get scared, I think, to give us a call. It's they don't know what to say. They think they're talking to, you know, a whole bunch of people. You're just leaving a voicemail to a couple of dudes.
Leave a dirty joke if you want to.
Well, I don't know. It depends on the dirty joke. If it's like off color jokes. To the point of... we need to be careful with off-color jokes.
I love putting you on the spot. Mike, your face right now.
That's it for this week's voicemails. Again, you can leave us one at 1-877-327-5786 or 1-877-DARK-PTN. We'd love to hear from you, even if it is just to say hi and to tell us to go shit in our hats. If you're stumped for what to chat with us about, a quick story is welcome. All right, we have some patrons this week. We've got three.
Yay.
So first up, we have Marlene Sanders. I don't know where Marlene is from or what she does, Matthew.
Marlene is a resident DJ.
Okay.
At a nightclub in her hometown.
What's her hometown, Matthew?
Saturdayville.
Where is Saturdayville?
It's between Fridayville and Mondayville and Sundayville.
Is there an actual place called Saturdayville?
Are you actually Googling that?
Yeah, I totally am. I'm curious.
You're so easy to fool.
Well, we need actual places, though.
No, we don't.
Okay.
Why do we need actual places?
Well, I would prefer to have them. Next, we Next we have, well, thank you, Marlene.
Thanks, Marlene. We
Matthew's
appreciate
an
it.
Asshole, just so you know. Next we have Bruce Crowder. And Bruce, I don't know where he's from or what he does. So
Bruce?
Where's... Don't Bruce? Tell me he's from some fake place.
No, he lives on the Bruce Peninsula. It's named after him.
Where is the Bruce Peninsula, Matthew?
You don't know where the Bruce Peninsula is?
Well, no, I don't.
Ontario.
Well, that's why, because I'm not from Ontario.
So it's essentially this peninsula that separates. You have Georgian Bay on one side and Lake Huron on the other.
And it's like a park, isn't it?
It is one of my favorite places on this planet. And I've traveled to many places because you get like the rocky, really deep Georgian Bay on one side. And then you can like literally walk to the other side of the peninsula in 15 minutes. You have these sandy beaches. And it's just gorgeous up there. And there's native flowers up there that you can't find anywhere else, and grottos and all kinds of stuff.
So what does Bruce do up there?
He runs a fishing expedition company.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So have you been fishing up that way?
Of course I have.
Sure. what kind of fish did you catch?
Pike.
Pike?
Yeah.
Caught some pike.
Pikes always freaked me out as a child.
Well, I find they're really bony. I've had pike to eat, and I don't like it. I find it too bony.
I thought they were the scary fish when I was a kid.
Yeah. We had sculpin in Nova Scotia. So if you look that up, that's way scarier, I think, than a pike. But anyway. Next up, from Mission, British Columbia.
Mission!
We have Rachel Roberts. Hello, Rachel Roberts.
Rachel Roberts in Mission.
Okay. What on earth does Rachel Roberts do there in Mission? She's neighbor to us, so pretty close by.
Yeah, I always mix up Mission with that other place.
Abbotsford?
The place that has the it used to have the big country and western festival. Country.
That's Merritt.
Merritt. I always mix up Merritt and Mission.
Oh, really? They're quite far from each other.
I know. So. I know. And I don't know. I have no idea why I mix them up.
Oh, well.
None whatsoever. I think she's a firefighter in Mission.
Rachel's a firefighter in Mission. Yep. Oh, that's noble work.
It is noble work, isn't it?
Yeah. We need more firefighters.
I have a perspective on life that you could take a guy who's like a five in real life and you put him in a fire person's outfit and he's instantly easily a nine.
Oh, dear. Matthew likes a man in uniform with a big hose.
And a little red hat.
Oh, boy. And we have a donut money donor this week.
Yay. Thanks, everybody.
And her name is Nicole Madden. Nicole, I don't know where she's from, though.
She's Manhattan.
Manhattan.
Yeah, she's right there in the center of it all.
There you go. New York.
New York.
I still have not been to New York City. That's something I need to remedy.
That's just ridiculous.
I know it is. I've been to a bunch of different places, but just never New York. What does Nicole do there in New York?
What does Nicole do in New York?
Mm-hmm.
She runs an art gallery.
Oh, that's nice.
It's like digital, like installation, like light art.
Okay.
Yeah.
Like that that Van Gogh stuff that we see here.
No, hers is much better than that cheap stuff.
Oh, good. Thank goodness.
Yeah.
Well, that's nice. Well, thank you, Nicole, and thank you to Marlene, Bruce, and Rachel.
Thank you, guys.
Patrons.
We much appreciate it. It is very much appreciated.
Yeah. Thanks to all our patrons and Donut Money donors, past and present, for your generosity. It helps to keep the show going. You can become a patron of Dark Poutine at patreon.com/darkpoutine. For a one-time donation, you can send us Donut Money via PayPal using our email address, darkpoutinepodcast@gmail.com. If you don't already subscribe to the show, it would mean a lot if you did. You can easily find Dark Poutine on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. If you haven't gotten yours yet, my book, Murder, Madness, and Mayhem, is available to order via a link on the Dark Poutine website. And speaking of darkpoutine.com, please check it out for show notes and other cool stuff. We'd appreciate it if you took the time to give Dark Poutine a like or a follow on Facebook and Instagram. Most importantly, thank you for listening, and tell your friends about us. Word of mouth is a powerful thing. So that's it for this episode of Dark Poutine, and until next time, don't forget to be a good egg and not a bad apple.
Bye. Oh, you're waiting for me.
Yeah, I'm waiting for you to say goodbye.
Okay, bye, everybody.
Bye.